So this is one of my favorite interviews, an interview with Hossein Rahman, who is the CEO and founder of Jawbone. You probably know them best for their Bluetooth headsets, but they also make things like this awesome Up. This is the newly revamped one. He talks about some of the challenges in manufacturing and how he can make this thing not break when you flex it. Also talks about a time when he sat down with Steve Jobs and he completely ripped apart his product. It's a great interview. Hope you enjoy it. All right, let's start at the beginning.
Yeah,
where'd you grow up?
I grew up just outside of LA, Southern California. Mm-hmm. My parents were from the Indian subcontinent, so I had a kind of a wacky upbringing in that I was in LA, you know, sort of half my life, and then traveling back to Asia a lot. And so I got to see a lot of the world when I was really young, which is, you know, at the time felt very helter-skelter because I didn't always feel like I was part of one culture completely. Like, when I was over there, I was an American. When I was here, I was from somewhere else.
Right.
But the thing that was really valuable to me now in my life and the way it is now is that I feel comfortable everywhere. I feel like, you know, I was young, going through Asia, traveling there by myself. Me and my parents doing all these things, and it just gave me an appreciation for the world and all the different places that you can find inspiration. So,
were you always into computers back then, or how did you get involved in technology?
Yeah, no, so I was into making things. Mm-hmm. I actually, when I was young, I wanted to be a sculptor, and I was into objects and materials and how beautiful you could make these things. I really liked what.
Did you do like clay pots and stuff like that with the spinning wheel?
No,
I always wanted to learn how to do that.
Like the sort of
what's the that? Ghost, the movie.
Yeah, right. Exactly. No, I was more into like sort of, you know, sculptural elements. Like I was really into like car design, and what, you know, sort of how could you make aerodynamic shapes? Mm-hmm. What would the future look like?
We're the same age, so I'm trying to think. Like, was that like Lamborghinis you were into?
Totally,
back
like
then?
Countach.
Yeah,
and, like all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then like what was next, right? And so interestingly enough, I was really into like technology from that perspective, which is how would we experience it in like our physical world? Like as a really young kid, I was super into the Jetsons. And I always felt like I always still think about this now from a technology perspective, was like, where's all the stuff that was in the Jetsons? Like, mm-hmm. I feel like we were promised that
totally.
As kids. And some of it's there, but some of it's not. We're like Star Trek. So I was into like sci-fi
right.
and communications and cars and products, but I like stuff. Like mm-hmm. I like things. I wanted to always make stuff. And so that's why I was really sort of fascinated by sculpture, because I would sort of craft these like kind of clay plaster models of future looking cars. I wanted to go to art school. My dad was not really that supportive of it. So I ended up going to Stanford and did sort of mechanical engineering and design
awesome.
Before there was a D school, because that was where my focus was and my interest. And it turned out to be a great thing, because we were at Stanford in the mid-90s and it was this like incredible explosion of entrepreneurial ideas.
The internet.
The internet coming. And
what'd you build? What were some of the projects you did while you were there?
Oh man, like one of my first shop classes, I made a kind of a futuristic looking bookshelf out of milled ABS, and it was in these sort of trapezoidal shapes, and then I had like a metal plane that was going through it, and I was really into how do you fix the shelf in the metal. It was like a magazine rack bookshelf thing, and it was like, how do you fix that shelf and make it stable without showing any lines of where it would connect into the support structure, mm-hmm. right?
So were you learning CAD at this time as well?
Yeah, we were doing like, you know, some of the Pro E and some of this kind of stuff and building. The cool thing about Stanford those days is that you were pretty cross-functional. So I took like a bunch of electrical engineering classes, so I understood like electronics and sort of how computers worked at a real fundamental level. And then obviously you had to do software as well. So it was like an amazing time, because everyone was creating. There was this incredible excitement about what the possibilities were. I remember, I think it was like my sophomore year, the first time like I saw the web, right? And back in those days, it was like Yahoo and ESPN.
Right.
ESPN was so early.
That's crazy.
To the web.
I wonder who it was over there.
Somebody was like on it. Like,
yeah,
ESPN was one of like the biggest destinations in like 1994.
Had like 50 unique visitors a day.
right. And I remember learning to code in HTML and being like, wow, this is amazing, and having like your profiles show up. And they made you, as an engineering student, everyone had like their own web page. And even those days, like email, like when I got to Stanford, dude, like walked in the computer lab and there was this like black monolith in the corner. And it was all a bunch of like Apple, you know, Macintoshes and stuff, Mac SE, I don't even remember what versions of Mac it was. And then there was this like thing, each computer lab had a black box. And it was this like really interestingly designed object. and it was Next.
Oh, interesting.
Right, and so there was like a Next in every computer lab because Apple was always really supportive of that journey. And then I remember sort of partway through, we went from learning how to do everything on Macs, right? From like, I remember setting up an email address for the first time, doing all that stuff, and then we went from Macs and we switched over to PCs.
Right.
Right, and so much of that CAD software and all that kind of thing was on PC, so it was like a completely different world. And what was interesting is like this was also right around the time. So this is now kind of I started Stanford in '93, and so by the like mid '90s, I remember the first time we saw Palm Pilot, and my co-founder.
I wanted one so bad.
Oh, dude, it was crazy. It was such an amazing object, right, of desire, and that it sort of. That's why I think I got really into making things because I always had that sort of passion around materials and how you feel stuff and that physical experience with it. And when you combine that with what you could do with technology. So my co-founder Alex actually was the first dude I ever met at Stanford who had a Palm Pilot. And he was pretty badass because no one on campus had one at that time.
This
is
so
like
cool.
This is like 95, 96, right? And
yeah.
It was like I remember sitting in like a class and the screen lighting up with the green backlight and how sick it was and being able to like upload your contacts and graffiti and all that stuff. And so that was actually a big part of our inspiration behind Jawbone because we were sort of thinking about user interface at that time and we said, this is great in this kind of mobile device environment to be able to, you know, now take something that you used to have to type into, reduce the interface to something that's very natural, which is writing. But guess what? When you're walking down the street or you're trying to be mobile with that kind of a device, that's not a great interface. So our vision was, could we try to create sort of essentially like Siri, and this is kind of like 96, 97, like a voice controlled interface for mobile devices, right? Which would be on top of the next generation of graphical input.
How would you do
input.
That though? Because like 96, 97, there was no Bluetooth at that point, right?
Well, we weren't even thinking about Bluetooth. We were just thinking on the device, could you create a layer on top of the OS?
What would you, would it be an app for a Palm Pilot?
But there
would
were no apps then.
Right,
so, right.
What
so
were
we were trying
create?
To figure out how to like layer on top of the operating system. It was like pretty complex.
Yeah, how would you even do that? Would you partner with Palm Pilot?
Well, we were trying to architect it, but we started from like the user problem, which is like, how would you integrate speech recognition? So like, what my partner Alex was doing was a lot of like, how would the menu structure work and how would you come on top of this? And then we looked at, well, does this mean that we have to like build our own device on top of this? Like, how does this all work? And then we started to realize, actually before we even got to like, how would we put it on top? You'd have to work really closely with the manufacturers, right? But we realized that everything we wanted to do with speech recognition was like virtually impossible.
The computing power wasn't there?
The computing, the recognition accuracy wasn't there. And basically speech recognition is like one big search problem, right? And what happens when you get on the street and there's other people talking or there's music playing or whatever it is, and everyone's experience is call into like United Airlines, trying to find your flight information with an automated assistant, it doesn't work all the time,
right?
And a lot of that is because of this variability in the background environment. So we said, well, if we could figure out how to clean up that inbound signal going into the speech recognition system, we could have a really revolutionary effect on the accuracy of that, right? And this is right around the time we had sort of formed the company, Alex and I were done with school. This is like sort of 99, 98. We started to like think about how would we implement this type of a speech recognition layer on top of these OSs. A big business development challenge, by the way.
Did you go into, did you have a little side jobs at that point in time to kind of pay the bills? Or how were you able to go straight from like graduating school to this research project?
Well, we basically were we were fortunate in that like we had made a little money through like internships and stuff like that. And like, look, my co-founder and I were like, both of our older brothers were like living. My older brother got to Stanford, and his was in the business school. My co-founder Alex, so we're both actually like squatting in our older brother's apartments.
Okay,
and actually the first like incorporated address of Jawbone was my older brother's apartment at 555 Stanford Ave, which I think is now like a Starbucks or something. It was on Stanford Avenue, like right across from the graduate student housing. So that's how we were able to kind of scrape by, as we had like a little bit of cash, but didn't have to like pay for housing. And we were figuring this out, and this is sort of like 99 now. And
so you're still in your first job out of school.
This is the only job I've ever had.
That's amazing.
I've had one job, dude, which I feel lucky about, you know, and it's been sort of an up and down journey through that. And there were times where it looked like I might need to have another job. But fortunately, sort of been up and to the right as of late. But It was unbelievable because we basically found this amazing, our chief scientist, Greg, who was the inventor of Noise Assassin.
What year was this?
This is like circa 99.
Okay.
He developed, he was doing his PhD thesis at Lawrence Livermore mm-hmm. National Labs, and at the lab, which by the way is out in the East Bay, and it's like the
How
largest.
How did you find him?
One of our old EE professors had been approached by these guys. They were doing really crazy stuff with sensors to understand like human speech. And we thought, wow, they were using these micropower radars to detect when your vocal folds were vibrating.
Whoa.
Which turns out to be a perfect indicator of when you're talking, right? And so basically, we looked at that and we said, wow, if you could know when someone's talking, you can therefore get rid of all the noise, because you can separate those two things if you're looking at an acoustic signal, mm-hmm. right? And then when you know it's pure speech, that'll make the recognition thing work a lot better. So that was the interesting thing.
So you kind of record the background noise so you know what that is?
You're recording all the acoustic, that's right, you're recording all the acoustic signal, mm-hmm. and then when you get this detection of when speech is going, you subtract out the model that you made of all that noise. Mm. This was like the core innovation. And so the way the whole thing started is like, look, we said, there's this problem of interface. We want to be doing speech-driven stuff, which, by the way, I still believe in. And it was when Siri came out, we were just like, wow, this is what we had essentially wanted to build, but it needed to be so deeply integrated into the OS. So I don't know what we were thinking in terms of how we would have actually pulled that off, mm-hmm. Execution-wise. I guess we would have like pitched it to Palm or Nokia or one of these guys like Bias or whatever. But we ended up just stumbling on this like core technology. And when we built that, the Noise Assassin technology, it turned out to be the biggest breakthrough in mobile audio in like 30 years.
Tell me, I for sure read all the articles and I had the first Jawbone when it came out, but jump back to the point when you first started building that. How do you even start to come up with a prototype?
Yeah. So
you've got this thesis and you're like, okay, I think this is what's gonna work.
So the way you do it, I mean, you do it on like breadboards and like circuits and you put these things together, and we had like duct tape sensors, and I mean, it was real science projecty stuff, and you'd tape them to your face. And
so you were like taping stuff to your face?
Totally.
That's when you had that little nub, that was like the first thing
you
used.
It was an accelerometer.
Oh, interesting.
Right?
So that was an accelerometer?
These are the same, you know, earlier versions of accelerometers that are in up. Which is the interesting thread that goes all the way through. So we were looking at sensors and what they could do really early, right?
And you started off with like huge.
Yeah, I mean, it was big. Large. We took like off the shelf headsets and like cut them up. And I mean, it's real like science projecty stuff. I'm sure it's around here somewhere, but it was cool. And we used to travel with these things. And sort of post 9/11, it was crazy because we had all these like wires and boxes with tape and these Pelican briefcases. It was crazy, you know? But yeah, so that was like the dawn of noise suppression, what we called Noise Assassins, how we built it. Turned out to be this huge breakthrough.
You formed the company at that point.
Yeah, we started the company in 99.
And did you get funding? Did you take funding?
We'd taken a little bit of angel funding in sort of late 99, early 2000.
So you just met with some investors and kind of showed them
the
prototype?
Yeah, but listen, it was an awesome, well, we had a bunch of slides of what we were going to do. This was even before the prototype was going. We had some noise samples of what we could do. And I mean, it was awesome. Like the optimism, I don't know if you remember, the optimism in like 99 for ideas was
totally.
Incredible. Like it was unbridled.
You got really lucky. You barely missed 2000.
We hit the window, right?
Yeah.
and then it was like that optimism turned to darkness.
Right, for years.
for years, right? And it's funny, I tell a lot of entrepreneurs now, like it was not like a founder-friendly valley at all.
Right.
Right, it was like, come up with an idea as a founder, make it, we'll take it, thank you very much, hire a team, you guys can like hang out in the back somewhere, right? And I think it was really, frankly, Steve Jobs and a few people like that, and even Zuck, who sort of changed the course of like how the investment community viewed founders running companies and saw that you could build these great companies if you sort of could help these guys become great managers and mm-hmm. great leaders of businesses, right?
Yep.
And I think that's been a wonderful transformation in the industry, because I can tell you it was not like that mm-hmm. in 99, right? So, but anyways, we were fortunate. We convinced some people to give us a little bit of capital. It was about like $1 million. And we started to take those prototypes and really refine them. And the original business model was to license our technology. So we thought,
was it going to be software that you would license out?
It would
there?
Be algorithms that were enabled by sensors.
All right.
So what you had to do was basically figure out how to get some contact on the skin to do this accelerometrics. Then you had to figure out how to add another microphone, right? So when we were going, what we did sort of starting in like early 2000s, we started going and seeing all the handset guys. Because we thought, wow, this is going to be like the Dolby of the mobile space. Mm-hmm. We're going to license this thing everywhere. It's even bigger than speech recognition. It like allows you to communicate in the noisiest environments. We had these amazing demos with like weed whackers and all kinds of stuff. Later, when we started working with DARPA, we did them and we tested in tanks and helicopters and all kinds of like crazy places.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and so basically what we ended up doing was taking this sort of raw technology and trying to figure out like a reference design that a phone guy could go take, and we would license them mm-hmm. the whole thing. But it was a hard sell because they were like, there were so many things trying to get into phone, and this was like the explosion of the mobile phone industry, mm-hmm. right? This is when like Nokia really started to take off. All these devices were really
prices were finally coming down to the point where everyone
it was getting mass, right? Yeah. You're starting to see people who were dumping landlines. This is kind of like circa 2000. The apps that were killer in mobile. I remember in those days the killer mobile apps were like ringtones.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, totally.
And
that was big business.
It was a big business for a while. There were no sort of application platforms, and then email was a killer app, right? Which is amazing. And so this is even before smartphones, right? Mm-hmm. You're talking like just, you know, really basic, simple devices. And even in those days, there were like sort of simple feature phones, and people were, that we went to like, you know, see, you know, Espoo, Finland to see Nokia. We were in Lund to see Ericsson, and spent a bunch of time in Schaumburg, Illinois. You know, coldest winter I ever spent was out there trying to convince Motorola to like put our technology in the
devices. Did anybody buy it at all?
They were really interested in the performance, but they saw this, like they had to put a new mic in, they had to put another sensor. They had to then pay us a licensing fee. So they were like, look, you know, if we do this, it's going to be a very small licensing fee. And then one of the things that happened to us is we've been talking to other people like in the headset space, in Plantronics and Jabra. And we thought, wow, this is pretty interesting. Where our technology is really disruptive in this space. Could we do something where we actually build our own product? Because we thought, well, that's when we started to conceive of it, saying, you know, maybe we don't want to be in licensing business, maybe we want to like actually go back to our roots of making things mm-hmm. and actually build the whole thing. And that was hard, that was insane. Trying to raise money to do that in sort of 2003 was really challenging. We were fortunate enough to do it. And we made the first Jawbone headset in 2004. I don't know if you remember it. It was like silver and wire. That's when we teamed up with Eve Bahar, because the whole idea was like functional jewelry.
This is the cool thing that I really want to spend a second on that I'm fascinated by.
Yeah.
How do you say, I want to build a piece of hardware, and then go from that idea to prototypes, to manufacturing,
right,
to in the box, on the shelves at Best Buy? Like, right. How does that process happen?
Yeah, so it's easier now than it was. I mean, what we ended up doing was hiring people. We went to Asia. This is when I started spending a lot of time in Asia, sort of circa 2003, in China, Taiwan.
How do you
China.
Know? I mean, like, let's say I wanted to go build a device tomorrow. Like, who do you call? Like, you don't just like fly to China.
Right. Well, the interesting thing is, like, now those companies out there, the big manufacturers, are used to seeing interesting new ideas from startups. In 2002, 2003, they were not interested in a bunch of, you know, kids with big ideas.
Did they have English-speaking people there that you could go
with? Some. We would travel with translators and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, it was like this sort of crazy challenge.
What was it like? You go out there and you sit down at a table and you have a translator and you're like, here's my idea. Like,
yeah.
One, it could be copied, it could be stolen, it could, like, they could take your spec.
Well, see, this is the thing that we knew, is that our technology was so complicated and there was so much IP, intellectual property around it, that it was gonna be hard for them to figure this out on their own, right? So at least we had that sort of comfort level, right? That if anyone was gonna build it, it was difficult. But here's the thing that we learned, was that you need so many things to line up on the hardware side to get it right. You need the battery technology to come along with you and sort of get to the right place. You need the chipsets, that the computer hardware, right, to enable your application.
Did you find someone that had done this before? Was that the key to
we had a few people around us who had done that before. Eve had built a lot of products, right? So we had some of that. We had a number of people who came on board who had worked at Palm, who had worked at Apple.
So a big part of your job then was just recruiting people.
Yeah, and was trying to convince them that we should do this. Mm-hmm.
So you would go and sit down with a potential candidate that had a bunch of experience in manufacturing and hardware design, things like that, show them your idea,
right,
and say, I want you to join us because I need your help in launching
this. Yeah, and we had hired some senior people to help us too.
Gotcha.
So they recruited some of their friends and people they worked on. and all that kind
of
stuff.
So that's kind of your strategy, is like get an anchor in that can then bring in people they've worked with in the past.
That was the strategy. I think that the interesting thing that we learned through that process, so our first Jawbone headset was like, it didn't do that well. It got a lot of critical acclaim, but the product experience wasn't totally resolved.
Like, what was wrong with it?
It had these proprietary connectors, so there was only a limited universe of phones. Like, it only supported some Nokia phones, some Motorola phones. It had like a little dongle clip that you clipped on your shirt, and it was wired. It was just sort of this kludgy implementation. And that's what you realize when you do hardware, is we actually got it working. One of the other things that happened to us along the way in 01, when things really went south in the technology industry, where there was just no money available, DARPA came to us and they said, you know what, we see a lot of promise in this technology that you have for noise cancellation. We'd like to use it as part of our next generation communication strategy for military applications. Hmm. And it was a great way for us to work with them. They gave us a bunch of research contracts. It was a great way for us to take really kind of theoretical science, raw science, and productize it and get it to a form where we could refine it and utilize it. So it was kind of like people's taxpayer dollars hard at work. Mm-hmm.
And then you share technology back to them.
They have rights to use it for, you know, sort of whatever
applications, whatever projects,
militaristic endeavors that they want to do with it, of which we're not privy to anymore. But so they have the ability to do that. But it was a great way for us to sort of take this technology, refine it, build new prototypes. You know, because we had sort of an engineering background on hardware, we knew what it meant to tool up parts. We knew what the electronics needed to look like. There's a lot of, there at the time, there were like these little, you know, consulting shops around the valley where you could go to them. They'd make you a circuit board. They'd help you design the circuit board. They'd help you think about the mechanicals for manufacturing. So there are these pockets of people that work for a lot of big companies. I mean, HP and Palm and Dell and all these guys use a lot of these designers in that ecosystem.
And so when we teamed up, that still exists today.
It absolutely still exists today. I mean, you get
like
these
little
firms,
like,
but even firms like IDEO provide some of these services, right? Mm-hmm. But like when we started working with Eve, he knew a guy that was like a great mechanical engineer that could help us figure out how to do the surface modeling of all of the exterior parts and what they needed to sort of look like in CAD to be injection molded and all that kind of stuff. So it's a lot of work and it's complex. And I think that what we realized in that first go around with the product is you need all of those things to come together. Like that's the interesting thing about doing hardware is you can't let up on one piece because you don't have the ability to iterate in market. You can't put it out there. And this is what's been fascinating to us is the companies evolve. We have so much sort of software now, not only powering our devices, but applications that people interact with, particularly on something like Up. And the thing that's crazy is like, it's such a different mindset where you can put something out, you can see what users say, you can test a reaction, you can iterate, you can sort of evolve. Like when we want to iterate something, it's like 12 weeks to create a new machine tool to injection mold a part, right? If we just want to change the radius on a surface by half a millimeter.
It's such a different world.
It's such a different world. So what it requires you to do is be a lot more disciplined about what problem are you trying to solve for the user, right? And make sure that you're ruthless about every decision that you make underneath that umbrella. And fundamentally, you have to sort of think about, is somebody gonna pay me for what I'm doing here more than what it takes for me to actually do it? So it's just, I've gotta be able to sell it to somebody and they see enough value in it for more than what it costs me to make it. And if you can't do that, you're screwed. Like you can't make it, right?
So what do you think about, you know, one of the things, and I'm pulling from various conversations we've had over the last few weeks and hanging out, but like, what do you think about, you're telling me that you had a team, or you still have, obviously, a very large team of people that are working on a single device.
Yeah.
That are working on the manufacturing side, on the development side, on the design side, on the, you know, changing one little mold. Like,
the team stack up is crazy. I mean, you're talking about, for like a headset or an audio product, you have a digital signal processing team that are building the audio algorithms and the things that noise cancel or make the sound three-dimensional.
What's the entire, what are you talking, 50 people, 75 people to build something like that?
Probably on that order, right? Then you have a bunch of mechanical engineers, you have people that are laying out the circuit boards that are interfacing with manufacturing engineers. So, there are people who are sourcing parts, right? There are people who are looking for new materials. Like on Jambox, we bend metal in ways that no one's ever done before.
So
we have to have people who find the vendor that can do that.
What I'm shocked at is that I see Kickstarter projects launching, and you must just be laughing your ass off when you see some of these Kickstarter projects, with like a team of like two guys being like, we're gonna make the next, and it's like some crazy like hoverboard or something like that is right. insane.
Right, right.
Like, is that just craziness? Like, is that, is, because a lot of these, I mean, I probably invested in four or five projects. Right. I would say probably, I think all of them have been delayed
right.
by months and months.
Right.
Is that just gonna be the norm? And will these projects ever get off the ground? Like, does it really require a team of 50 people to launch something like this? Or is there something that's having some efficiency on the back end, like over in China, that we're not seeing that's gonna make it possible for smaller teams to actually get out quality,
produce
quality products?
I think it depends on the product, right?
Right, everything's different.
Everything's different. So I think from when we started to now, first of all, the ecosystem's changed dramatically. So you get the Chinese manufacturers who have a lot of these resources in-house. So you can go to them with a concept and say, I wanna build this thing.
Is the quality control really there though?
We believe that to get to the level of, like, my view is like, look, Apple changed everything in terms of what people's expectations are
right.
of what they should experience in a physical product. Mm-hmm. They set the bar so high in terms of that integration between the hardware, the software, how beautifully machined all these things are. That's the expectation that we have
that's
for great hardware.
You guys, though, too. I mean,
well,
I would say there's
you.
Only no. other, you're probably the only other company that I know that cares that much about design.
Yeah, well, thank you. No, and it's paid off for us, right? And that's just part of your DNA. But so to do that level of work and that level of craftsmanship, you've got to get your own people on the ground there mm-hmm. who know culturally how you think about stuff and can say no. Because everything when you're not on top of it, I don't care if this is in like consumer internet software or mechanical engineering, everything drifts to the lowest common denominator. Unless somebody's there to hold the line mm-hmm. and hold the standard, mm-hmm. right? And when you have large teams that are distributed all over the planet, you have an easier path to that lowest common denominator. And so I think that if you just throw things over the fence to Asia, that happens. Now, mm-hmm. that being said, a lot of these companies are getting better and better because they've been inspired by what Apple's done. And they've mm-hmm. realized that you've got to raise your bar to that. It's not just about the cheapest parts or the least, you know, the lowest cost manufacturing, that you want quality and that people demand that. And if you do it well, there's a market of bazillions of people who buy that stuff. But going back to your Kickstarter question for a second, I think what's awesome about Kickstarter is that you now, like if I think about the product development process of hardware, you start with a concept, which is really about what is the problem that we're solving, mm-hmm. right? And are we really addressing a user need? Then you start to see like, all right, what's the landscape around that? Are there solutions that are doing it? Do we have to invent technology? Do we have to buy technology? Do we have to license it? How do we pull all those enabling core technologies together? Mm-hmm. How do we put that all? We start to concept that, really start to get tight on what the definition of the product looks like. What Kickstarter allows you to do at that stage is to go out and test. Do people actually give a shit, mm-hmm. right? Is there like a there that people will be into, right?
Pre-production.
Right.
Yeah, which
so
is
I think
awesome.
Which is awesome, because it takes a lot of the guesswork out of it.
That's interesting, because you don't do
care.
You never do that, right?
You never do that.
You go out and you launch something, and you're like,
we're looking around the corner.
Yeah.
I mean, Jambo's a great example. Like, I would say half the organization here thought we were crazy. We had a bunch of guys who'd worked at Sony on building speakers, and they were like, this is the dumbest idea ever. Why are we building a speaker? Like, this is a hard market, there's lots of people in it. And we were like, no, we're gonna turn the thing into a computer, and it's gonna be for your phone, and it's gonna be for Spotify, and it's gonna be a totally new world. And we were able to like carve out this new space, and it worked big. But it was
that like, you sitting there and just kind of like, how did you identify?
Well, it was crazy. So I got one of our guys brought me a prototype. It's a funny story, actually. He brought me this like prototype, and it was this like little black, quite ugly actually, sort of black, plastic thing.
Did he go off and work on it without your permission or anything?
Yeah, this happens. You know, people.
That's cool. That's a great
We love that. We want
have.
That. We want the people to tinker and sort
that's
of come up with ideas.
Many great. I mean, Gmail. Tons of great products have come out of tinkering.
With people tinkering. Yeah. No. So we encourage that, right? And so, you know, one of our key guys brings me this thing. I'm like, what is that? He's like, it's a speaker. And I also was like, really? I mean, like, that's a crowded category. There's so many people in it. And this thing is like hideous looking. What are you talking about? And he was like, just listen to it. I was like, nah, really? I don't want to do this. And he's like, just listen to it, man. And so I listened to it. And I was like, oh my God. this thing is like this big and it sounds like it's this big. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I was like, wait, now can I use that with like my phone? What if we did this? What if we made it a beautiful object? And then we just saw it, right? And then that was the journey. And that was a product from concept to ship was 6 months, mm-hmm. which was amazingly fast, right? And we got it out and it's done, you know, millions of units, and it sort of changed the landscape of that industry.
Everybody has one. It's crazy.
Everyone has one. It's like changed it's the awesome. Landscape of that industry. But so going back to that thing about it's amazing and remarkable what Kickstarter has done, because now you can validate your idea, right? In a big way and be like, people care. Mm-hmm. All of the other stuff in terms of like, how do you build it? How do you do the engineering validation, build the prototypes, refine it, scale it, distribute it? All that stuff is hard. Mm-hmm. Right? How do you get to the right quality output? All that stuff is still complicated.
Yeah, we were talking before we turned the cameras on, and you were saying, I mean, it's you have low points in your life where you're like, you hit walls, right? I mean, even with Up off the when you got off the ground with
massive.
Up, right?
I mean, Up was after we sold 10 million units of things.
That's insane. Right?
And we know how to make really small,
and
complex.
And you ran into manufacturing problems.
We ran into crazy, I mean, this was the craziest journey from a product perspective that we've ever been on. And in some ways it's turned out to be the most wonderful thing that ever happened to the company, because we've learned so much about how you make a computer that's wearable and waterproof and bendable. And what you realize about like wearable stuff like this, even the difference from going from your ears to your wrist, mm-hmm. is that a lot of stuff happens to you on your wrist that you don't even think about. Mm-hmm. Like we were testing this thing, we did like 46 weeks of user tests after we had the initial challenges. And it was crazy because we'd see these like traumatic failure events with these products, and we'd ask the people who were testing, we're like, what happened? They're like, nothing. We're like, no, something happened. This thing's like shattered inside.
Right.
And then going through the forensics of dissecting their day and understanding like how they move through the day, you realize they went home and their kid grabbed their arm and yanked the thing off. And they didn't even think about it.
Right, they just picked it back up. And it doesn't look shattered.
It doesn't look shattered.
Beautiful shell.
But the internals were like completely kaput, right? And she's like, oh my God, how do we like life-proof this stuff?
Right.
Right. How do we accommodate for that like normal, like you picked up your kid. And they,
it's like on a very like fast moving.
It's
like,
just, and you don't think about all of these.
You
don't think about the sort of how people move through their day and all that stuff. So we have to like design for that. We have to test for that. We have to build for that. And it was an interesting journey and a real labor of love and intensity. And then just, you know, the difference between, we argue here over millimeters, like fierce millimeters, like half a millimeter, because it makes a difference. The way you round that edge, the way you stuff the components, how thick the walls are that are encasing the electronics. It makes a difference about whether you'll wear it to bed, which then means I can't track your sleep if you don't wear it to bed.
Interesting.
Which means I get no engagement on that part of my app. And so when I look at the class curves, sleep's dropping off. Why? Because it's too big. No one wants to wear the fucking thing. Right?
You told me one time that you wanted to make it, like even if it wasn't working, you wanted to make it beautiful enough to where people consider it jewelry, right?
Jewelry, and that's the design bar. So when we team up with Eve, we say, look, Eve, you gotta give us something that is so cool that people would love it as an object if it had no functionality. Mm-hmm. And if we can achieve that, it's kind of like a holy grail, right? And if we can get to that place, then we know that we're winning. Because ultimately, like the tech has to disappear. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that we've learned again and again and again, is that people at a mass market level want the tech to just disappear. They
did
want
you
to
ever meet
like,
Jobs? Did you ever hang out with him? It seems like you guys have a lot in common.
I did. First time I met him was in 2004, right before we debuted our first, you know, sort of wired headset product at the D conference, where it was like, whenever that was, it was like May, June of 2004. It was the second D. We did this whole thing with Walton Caro where we were like weed whackers and blenders and demoed it on stage. It was crazy. But right before that, I met Steve for the first time, and we'd gone down there, and it was sort of set up by our big investor at the time, Yogan Dalal from Mayfield. He was like, go down and see Steve and just show him like what you guys are working on. So we went down there, and I have to tell you, it was like pretty tough, because basically for 45 minutes, he like ripped through every single deepest, darkest fear that we had about our product. And like, it was so quick.
He didn't even know about it?
He didn't know about it.
He didn't know about the product. He just walked in cold?
No, he walked in cold. Yogan had told him a little bit about it. We walked into this thing and he was just like, boom.
What did he say?
Straight, why is that edge that way? Why didn't you use a piece of silicon that would allow you to make this small? Why do you have like a thing on your ear than a clip? No one's gonna do that. The only place anyone would clip anything is in your mind. Like you've not thought about the consumer in this way. And you were like, wow, yes, I was nervous about that. And you're right. So that was the thing that was crazy. It was that it was so insanely commonsensical that you're like, of course, of course. It was just this level of like consumer insight and just thinking about like how people would use shit that you were like, damn, how did I miss that? And so in some ways it was hard as hell. Because it's like we'd taken all this time. It was like the first hardware product that we designed. We like working with Eve. We thought we were really good at like design, and like we knew all this stuff. And we went in front of like the God, and he was just like, it was not. It was not. It was like that, right? It was just like, and it was humbling.
Did that crush you when you went home at night?
It was crushing, but it was also like absurdly inspiring, because the thing that I kept coming back to was like we knew all this shit. Mm-hmm. We knew exactly what he was talking about. There was nothing there that it was like so different than, that's what I was saying, he exposed all these deep, dark things that we'd sort of hidden from ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it was probably one of the most like important moments in like my life around just being true to at a product level.
So do you say no a lot more after that meeting?
Yeah, well we just like put our, in what I realized is like we had to change the culture of our company.
Where
it wasn't,
what way?
It wasn't, well, because it's up to that point was, it was all about like, okay, we've defined something, we've got to ship it. Because we defined it. And then sometimes you realize when you're creating new things, that doesn't work. Because you'll build it and you realize, oh my God, that didn't work. Like, that's just wrong.
Like, right.
It's not right.
Just because you built it doesn't mean you have to ship it.
Doesn't mean you have to ship it, right? And I think that's true with hardware or software. Now, in hardware, it's a little harder because you just, the cost of doing it was harder. It's better now, but still, like,
That's a great point, though. It's also really difficult. Like, I'll give you an example. Like, we spent probably 3 or 4 months building one release of Dig, where I looked at it and I was like, it doesn't feel right, but it's gonna be a blow to all of the engineers if I say, hey, let's scrap this and do something
over.
Else.
Yeah, like, so how do you balance that,
yeah, exactly,
right?
How do you balance that?
That's the hardest thing. But I think if they know what the mission is, and the mission is like greatness,
right,
and you just are so passionate about the problem you're solving, and you can all look at each other and you have that trust where it's like, guys, we're not there. And it's not about egos or someone's opinion or whatever. It's about like, you just don't feel like you're doing the best work. The best people will go with that, I think.
Yeah, that's cool.
And they have to, right? I think you have to do that culturally if you want to be great and like change the game in an industry or redefine a category, not just be a Me Too thing.
So how were you changing your culture then, you said?
Well, we came back and we said, like, guys, we gotta like be hard on ourselves, right? And so when, like, this is a lesson that like has kept coming. Like, so when we did our first Bluetooth version, like the company almost died, and you know, because that wired product was not very successful, we went down to a really small group and we focused on making it Bluetooth so we could get rid of the connectors and do that. And we had created a design and we were sort of, you know, there's all these different phases of hardware development. You have like concept, engineering validation, design validation, you know, pre-production, testing, and then ramp. And we were kind of in the engineering, about to go into engineering validation and maybe design validation. And I'll never forget this, we went to CES, right? And this was, we were like lean, mean team, no money, we were sort of hustling, trying to get this thing going. And Eve and I walked around CES, and there were all these other Bluetooth headsets, and they were like much smaller than what we were doing. And yeah, we had a much cooler design and much cooler tech, but the thing was just like bloated. And he and I looked at each other, we were like, dude, we can't ship this thing. Like, it's just, it's not gonna work. Like, we're gonna do it, we've put all this energy into it, we've hustled to keep this thing alive.
That's a lot of work.
Pressure, right?
We
had to scrap everything, and it was just like massive. We came back, saw my co-founder, it was kind of the three of us.
How did investors feel about that?
Well, at that time, our investors had kind of just said, you know, you guys do your thing, because they sort of thought it was done. But it was even just our internal, like, my co-founder had been slaving on it, and there's a team of people that were working on it in Asia. We'd convince his manufacturing partner to help us. But, you know, when you argue from that position of like, is this gonna work with the consumer?
Right.
Ultimately, that's the most truthful thing that you can do. Because it's just so raw, it's so fundamental.
Sure.
Right, and you just, that's what I learned, like, weirdly from that conversation with Job, the first one, where it was like, if you stop being true to that, and every time we've stopped being true to that, we missed it, right? And that's, we always come back to that, which is like, what is that higher order thing? I know you guys are gonna be demotivated because we tried, but know that we're signing up for this journey and that there will be things we chuck. You gotta get, and so I think being, what we also have learned is,
you set that expectation up front.
We're getting better at it, you know? Like, it's still hard, because you just, sometimes you forget, and sometimes you think you've got the answer. And that's the hardest part about creation, right? And that's what, coming back to Kickstarter, like,
that's what's cool about Kickstarter, is you can kind of validate some of that stuff early on.
Do you invest in Kickstarter projects?
I do.
You
I
do?
Yeah, I've done like 12 of them.
What have you done that you really
like? I did like Twine. I haven't gotten it yet. I'm still waiting for it. so Twine, dude, send me the shit. That was my favorite one.
I did boosted boards, that skateboard.
Did you?
The electric skateboard. It was just
awesome.
So cool.
Did
I saw a demo
it?
Of it. Not yet.
So you know, I love the energy of making.
Yeah.
I love that people are getting into making stuff again. 3D printing is amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm happy about it. I just, what I want and what I hope for is that people really understand where they are in the cycle. Mm-hmm. And that you got to prove these things out. Go invest in getting it done right and do what it takes to do that. And don't shortchange that. Mm-hmm. Because you'll take these great ideas, like a badass electric skateboard, and it'll never ship and everyone's bummed. Because
yeah.
they would like that product to be in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's my sort of view of that. And I wonder if there's a way that you can connect that type of thing to somebody who can really make those. And is there a way that we can create sort of like a part of the industry where in the manufacturing side where there's these high quality bars, and it's almost like going to an academy of learning to make things at like an Apple-like level,
right?
Right? I don't know, maybe. That's an area of potential innovation.
Yep.
So
I know you got to run. I want to ask you one last question, though.
Mm.
Where does the up go in 5 years? I'm fascinated by this space, like the quantified self.
Yeah.
It seems like it feels to me it's like cell phones in like the early 90s. Like you look at it and you're like, oh, it's gonna be cool, and yes, I want to have one with me.
Yeah.
But it doesn't do anything but make phone calls. Like,
no.
What do you think these? Where will these devices go?
I think it's like. So when I think about this, I think about like, what have the killer apps in wearables been, right? And like, there was corrective eyewear, there was consuming audio, telling time. Is this a killer app in wearables? Should it be integrated into your clothes? And then how's it connecting to all the other things in your life? I believe that when you're wearing something, it's so personal and so intimate with you
mm-hmm.
that it's a better and deeper relationship than you have with your phone.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean in terms of
it's
identity?
It's a style type thing.
It's a style thing. And so like
people buy different watches.
Totally. Day, night, mm-hmm. weather differences. We don't wear the same shit here in San Francisco that we do, now that we do, well, I guess in the summer we do here, but in October we don't, right?
We
wear sort of different things. And so you have differences of what you wear based on seasons, time of day, your mood, all kinds of stuff. How do you adapt into that kind of behavior? How do you make this stuff so interwoven? How does it become you? How does it like be this storage of your personal likes and dislikes? How does it connect to everything?
Mm-hmm.
So I think health is an awesome part of that application, get people going,
mm-hmm.
because...
Is health a big driver for it, do you think?
It is, because the thing that's interesting to us, like when we got in this space, is I've never been in a category like this where every single person I talk to, like I still meet people who are like, you know what, I don't listen to music on my phone, I don't need a Jambox, or I don't want to wear a headset or whatever. When you talk to people about up, like I've talked to like tens of thousands of people now about this, like every single person cares, and they all want to get better, no matter if they're like a superhuman athlete, or they just haven't they're out of shape and haven't thought about it in a while, or they just wherever they are starting from, they all want to sort of get incrementally better. And
mm-hmm.
I think that the view here with something like this is like giving people the ability to understand things about themselves,
mm-hmm.
trying to translate that into meaning. So like, how does all this data relate to each other? And I'm fascinated by.
So it's a big. Do you think it's a big data problem? Or you think you?
Oh, I think it's a massive data thing.
So you think you collect a lot of data and you figure out things about.
Well, I think that's the thing, because I think that people want to understand what they should think about the data. There needs to be that human personalized touch around like what the data is. Like I had this crazy insight in Up when I was in New York over the break. I went to New York with my family, and I got there and I got this insight in the app. It was like, you sleep very little in New York City, but you move a lot. And I was like, of course.
And that's doing that today.
Yeah, that's doing
that's
that today.
That's crazy.
And I was like, of course that makes sense. This is the city that never sleeps. There's always something going on, but you're walking places, right? And just that level of insight to me was like triggered all these other thoughts about like, what would it take for me to go to bed early? How should I structure my schedule?
Mm-hmm. Just like, the awareness.
Just the awareness changes everything.
Yeah.
And so can you take that to the next level? Like I'm fascinated by like when we hang out, what is our behavior versus when you hang out with your fiance or
mm-hmm.
versus when you hang out with so-and-so, right? Do you eat this way? Do you feel this way?
It's like your beer drinking hand goes up 10 times more
right.
when you're hanging out with your bros.
Right, exactly. Versus when you're hanging out with your wife.
Yeah.
It's like you do different things or your kids, right? And what's your mood around that? And that's why we built some of that stuff into the app. So I think there's all that level of just like understanding how we are as people and
mm-hmm.
what drives things. Like why sometimes do I sleep like 4 hours a night and I feel amazing, versus I sleep 8 hours and I'm still tired.
What kind of problem is that to crack? Because there's been so many little startups, not little now, very large startups, like the Zio or whatever you put on your head and tracks your, I don't know what it does, but it, you know, when you wake up in the morning, it's supposed to wake you up at the right time so that apparently, like if you wake up within this window of not REM sleep, but the other sleep.
Light sleep, yes.
Then you get a better night's sleep.
We do the same thing, yeah. We
does
wake
that
you up
really
serious.
Work?
It does. I mean, it's actually how I live. I don't sleep that much, so I live on the...
I follow you on up.
You follow
up,
me
so
on
I
up,
see
you see my pathetic sleep.
I'm like, yeah. I only slept 3.5 hours last night.
Right. Yeah.
But you actually feel better, because it tells you...
Yeah, because I don't wake up out of deep sleep. Like, when you wake up out of deep sleep cycle, you're sort of groggy, because you're in this sort of real deep place.
That is the weirdest thing, where some mornings you wake up and you feel amazing with like 5 hours, and really crappy with like 9.
Right, exactly. And so it's like understanding that and understanding how it relates to the activity you did and where you were and, you know.
Do you have people, like I would imagine, I mean, how many people are you now at your company?
We're about 350.
So you have a team of people that are dedicated just on sleep?
Well, we have a team of people on that. We have a team of people just looking at the data and trying to help, like at a sort of broader level, create insights for people and try to create the machine learning around that.
So that will grow. That'll be a big part of your organization over time.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we're now sort of, we think of ourselves as like kind of hardware that's powered by software. We have a service with Up, and now it's like we have a data component. How do we help you with that data that we have? Because the whole idea is like make your life better, right? So that's where I think it's going. I think it's not just the health signals, but I think because people care so much, it's a great place to start. And then I think it gets into all kinds of crazy stuff where, you know, it's identity, it's all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So
I got to tell you, you relaunched the product here not too long ago, right?
It's been about like mid-November last year.
Yeah, so. And it's awesome. The software is amazing. Huge strides forward in the software.
Thank you. We learned. We learned. We went back to the drawing board. We thought about like every moment in someone's day and how they would interact with it. We spent a lot of time with guys like you who sort of have been creating applications that like hundreds of millions, if not billions of people love. And so what do you guys think about and how do we mix that with what we think about? And it was interesting, the journey was fascinating because what I realized about mobile apps, and this is like sort of one company's experience, is that it's actually a lot like the way we build hardware, where we've got to really define the problem set and create a really tight narrative and be really focused on are we driving to that problem set? Because in a mobile app, you don't have a lot of room to mess around. Mm-hmm. And nor do I think people get the opportunity to iterate a lot. You can iterate some, but you can't iterate around. So you got to get to a much higher level of resolution than you did necessarily on the web, right? Where there was a little bit more of a forgiveness and people were willing to come on
absolutely.
A journey with you, right?
Yeah, no doubt.
Whereas people are in and out of apps so quickly.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
You know, the thing is, if someone uninstalls, I mean, think about like, if Yahoo Mail or something launches a new version on the web, you'll be like, all right, I'll go log into my account just to see what it's all about.
Right.
But if you uninstall an app on your phone to convince someone to go back to the app store, find it, search, install it, it's
over.
It's over.
It's game over.
Yeah.
So that cycle is much harsher. And so
it
reminds
harsh.
Me a lot of hardware.
Yeah.
Where you've got to be like really ruthless about, dude, what problem are we solving?
Yeah.
Because we got one shot. And if not, it's out, we're done. So that was a big part of the journey too. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for being on the show. This
it's fun,
has been
man.
Amazing.
It was awesome.
Exactly the stuff I wanted to talk about.
Cool.
So we'll follow up when later on when you launch new stuff.
It was awesome, dude. It was
cool.
Fun. Thank you.